Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools. We are here to promote and to defend public education, but we're also here because we are against the public funding of private religious schools because we believe in the separation of church and state. Now, the idea of separation of church and state and public education goes back deep into the Enlightenment times, out of the French and the American Revolution. So there's a long history for what we stand for, and we're not ashamed of it. But the fascinating thing in the last week is that these issues have come to the surface. There have been a number of articles written about the separation of church and state because it's under tremendous pressure in the Supreme Court of the United States. As well as that, there has been very interesting articles written about the public provision as a solution to inflation. And the other thing, of course, that we've been concerned about for a long time since the 1980s is the idea that private is better than public and the privatisation of the public facilities which our ancestors paid for many years, for over 100 years. So we're going to have a very interesting time this afternoon talking about all of these issues. And we're leading off with our press release 1074, Renewed Interest in the Idea of Separation of Church and State, which is on our website at www.adogs.info. And here is Dale to read it to us. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is Dogs Press Release number 1074, Renewed Interest in the Idea of Separation of Church and State. Dogs are interested to find that in the current political climate, there's been growing interest in the time-honoured ideas of separating religion from the corridors of power and the public treasury. The wars in the Middle East and populist reactions against migration have thrown into perspective the problems inherent in clerics exerting influence in the corridors of power. Australia is not immune. And this is why the Dogs promote both the separation of religion from the state, as outlined in Section 116 of our Constitution, and the sole public funding of public schools, where we can teach our children to live together and tolerate our differences. So the following article, titled The Idea of Separating Church and State Has Deep Roots, written by Stephen K. Green, the director of the Center for Religion and Law Democracy, Williamette University, USA, printed in The Conversation on the 10th of July and reprinted in The Rationale, is just another in a series of such articles. He writes, "The Trump administration's Religious Liberty Commission released its report on June 26, 2026, on the state of religious freedom in the United States, declaring it to be under attack. The commission was established in May 2025 to identify and report on emerging threats to religious liberty, uphold federal laws that protect all citizens' full participation in a pluralistic democracy, and protect the free exercise of religion. Despite those altruistic goals, from the beginning, the Commission faced criticism that the composition and agenda of the body were slanted toward a conservative Christian perspective. The Commission conducted 7 hearings over the course of a year, taking testimony from approximately 100 witnesses. The draft report recounts numerous incidents of reputed bias and mistreatment of people based on their religious faith, and it places the blame on bureaucrats who exhibit a disdain for demonstrations of religious conviction. The report attributes much of this to the use of the metaphor wall of separation of church and state to justify excluding religious Americans from equal participation in the public square. As the author of the book Separating Church and State: A History, I argue that the Commission's broadside on the concept of separation of church and state is misplaced, but not new. Critics have portrayed the idea as anti-religious and ahistorical ever since the Supreme Court embraced it in 1947. In the 1947 landmark case of Everson versus the Board of Education involving public financial aid for religious education, the justices announced that they would use the concept of church-state separation as a guide for interpreting the religious clauses of the First Amendment to the Constitution. Those clauses state that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In that same decision, the justices also employed the metaphor of a wall of separation between church and state, a phrase borrowed from an 1802 letter from President Thomas Jefferson to an association of Baptist churches in Connecticut. At the time, the Baptists were a minority in a state that still maintained a religious establishment. Jefferson sympathized with their plight, employing the wall of separation metaphor to emphasize that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, and not to the legislative powers of government. The idea of separate spheres of spiritual and secular functions and authority was advanced by religious and secular thinkers to benefit both religion and the state. In his 5th century work, City of God, St. Augustine advanced the model of two entities, one spiritual and the other temporal or earthly, each with separate authority and functions. Augustine went so far as to use an image of two walled cities separated from each other as a means to protect the purity of the church. During the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, both Martin Luther and John Calvin distinguished spiritual from earthly authority and called for a division of labor between the two. Luther distinguished two kingdoms, a spiritual kingdom and a temporal kingdom that had separate authority. Similarly, Calvin wrote that Christ's spiritual kingdom and the civil jurisdiction are things completely distinct, and as such must always be considered separately because of the great difference and unlikeness between ecclesiastical and civil power. At the same time, religious reformers were employing concepts of walls, hedges, or other barriers to ensure that the secular and religious realms remained apart. Protestant Anabaptists, Mennonites, Hutterites, Brethren, took the theological idea of separationism to heart, seeking to keep their communities apart from what they saw as the corruptions of the fallen world. They were declining to swear oaths of allegiance to civil authorities or otherwise participate in civic functions. The early leader of the Mennonites, Menno Simons, used the term a separating wall to illustrate the degree of separateness their faith required from civil authority. Finally, Roger Williams, the Puritan-turned-Baptist founder of Rhode Island, advocated for complete religious liberty. He called for maintaining a hedge or wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world. Enlightenment figures such as John Locke also advanced notions of separation of church and state. In 1689, Locke wrote that the church must be absolutely separate and distinct from the Commonwealth and civil affairs. The boundaries on both sides are fixed and immovable. Influential British writer James Burke called for building an impenetrable wall of separation between things sacred and civil. The less the church and state had to do with each other, it would be better for both. Scholars believe that this was likely one source for Jefferson's famous 1802 letter to the Connecticut Baptists, where he used the same metaphor. Thus, members of the America's founding generation were familiar with the concept of distinct spheres of authority between religion and government, and the necessity of keeping those functions separate. Even though Jefferson used the wall metaphor only once, he worked assiduously throughout his life to advance religious freedom via church-state separation. James Madison employed similar imagery, such as calling for a great barrier between the two. Church-state separation wasn't just an imagery idea. It was a concept that many people embraced. As Madison wrote, "Religion and government will both exist in greater purity the less they are mixed together." As a result, to this day, many denominations and religiously affiliated groups, such as many Baptists, Seventh-day Adventists, and members of Reformed Judaism, among others, support the separation of church and state as essential for maintaining religious freedom. And church-state separation continues to receive popular support. According to the Pew Research Center in 2026, 54% of Americans say the government should enforce church-state separation, a consistent percentage, whereas only 13% believe it should stop enforcing it, down from 19% in 2021. Despite this pedigree, the Religious Liberty Commission's report expresses particular disdain for the wall metaphor, stating that the wall of separation phrase does not appear in the First Amendment or anywhere else in the Constitution. The report calls it a belabored metaphor that can wrongly imply that church and state are opposed to one another and must remain completely separate. The report also takes a narrow view of what is prohibited by the religion clauses, that the government may not officially prefer one religion over another, take over the functions of a church, or coerce religious observance, which would otherwise allow for other types of church-state intermixing, such as government funding of religious education. In her final opinion as a Supreme Court Justice in 2005, Sandra Day O'Connor, a judicial conservative, reflected on the importance of church-state separation to guarantee full religious freedom. "The First Amendment expresses our nation's fundamental commitment to religious liberty by means of two provisions, one protecting the free exercise of religion, the other barring establishment of religion." She concluded with a challenge: "Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" That the Commission's report ignores the benefit of church-state separation to American society is troubling. Back to you, Jean.
Well, this is the union, the Australian Education Union Victorian branch, are now entering into interesting negotiations about their pay and conditions with the Victorian government. And here is Andy to tell us about that.
Thanks, Jean. Victorian Government Schools Agreement negotiations to restart with the Allan government. The Australian Education Union has recommenced negotiations with the Allan Labor government on a new Victorian Government Schools Agreement for teachers, education support, and all school leaders in public schools. Victorian public schools remain the lowest funded in the country, with the state government deciding to cut $2.4 billion through to 2031. This has significant implications for students and for the workloads and associated conditions of our members, Australian Education Union Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly said. The state government's May offer did not go far enough to address the concerns of the majority of union members, and now the government must come back with a revised offer that addresses the needs of Victorian teachers, education support employees and principals. Tens of thousands of Australian Education Union members have engaged in a recent union survey about key concerns that they want to see addressed in a revised offer from government and the further industrial action steps they are willing to undertake. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy. And there's an update to that, because the teachers are very, very restless, and so they should be. We believe that they're the most important workers in our community. So on Tuesday the 17th, the AEU Joint Primary and Secondary Sector Councillors met and endorsed a statewide stop work on Thursday the 23rd of July. So whether you as a teacher, if you're listening, supported the government's previous offer or not, then it's good union members believe that you stand together and you campaign for a revised offer. Every member needs to stop work, we're told, and attend the march and rally to send the strongest possible message to the Allan government that the AAU members need a revised offer and they will not be ignored. So there might be some parents and other supporters of public education that might like to be there on that day, on Thursday, the 23rd of July. Next week. Here's an AAU spokesperson to tell you about it.
On Thursday, the 23rd of July, there will be a 24-hour statewide stop work of AAU members in our public schools. It's time to put the pressure on the state government to put a revised offer for decent pay and fair conditions. When the state government has made a decision not to fully fund our public schools, it means that it's the goodwill and the extra work of AAU members that are ensuring every one of our students gets the quality education that they deserve. And so the State Council, which met last night, also decided to put a ban on unpaid overtime. Why would we continue with the goodwill when the state government is showing no willingness to fully fund our schools? It's something that they must do, and they must do immediately. Remember, folks, it's by sticking together, by taking action together through our democratic decision-making processes and turning out for a 24-hour stop work, putting bans in place, that we will be able to get the revised offer that we need from the state government. Remember, we're stronger together.
Well, thank you very much. And of course, our public schools are in the dire states that they're in because so much money is going out to the private schools. And this is because the private schools have got very strong lobbyists in the government, and a lot of government politicians send their children to the private schools, of course. They follow the money. Well, the problem is there's money and there's money and there's corruption. And the ICAC Operation Rosny up there in New South Wales is examining the Catholic Schools New South Wales relationship with hard right Liberal Party links. This is the entanglement of religion and the state, and it leads to corruption. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. Independent Commission Against Corruption's Operation Rosny is to examine Catholic Schools New South Wales and hard right Liberal Party links. The state's anti-corruption watchdog is examining whether Catholic Schools New South Wales struck a secret agreement to hire Liberal Party operatives who then used their consulting fees to bankroll a major branch stacking scheme. In a surprise revelation, the Independent Commission Against Corruption revealed that the influential chief executive of Catholic Schools New South Wales, Dallas McInerney, was a focus of its broader investigation into the links between hard-right Liberals and fugitive Sydney property developer Jean Nassif. The ICAC has announced an investigation into fugitive property developer Jean Nassif and his alleged links to senior Liberal Party figures. Operation Rosny will allege that Catholic Schools New South Wales, the governing body for 600 diocesan Catholic schools, made undeclared political donations exceeding legal caps under a scheme authorised by McInerney. The precise mechanics of any alleged schemes, the total funds involved, and any political decisions influenced will be outlined in the public hearings on July 27th. However, the Herald's been told by multiple sources, unauthorised to speak publicly, that the Commission's focus on Catholic Schools New South Wales surrounds payments to consultants and lobbyists, and whether that money was then used to support branch stacking. The ICAC hearings are expected to involve arguments about whether the work and subsequent invoices were legitimate. The line of inquiry is a topic of discussion within the Liberal Party ahead of the commencement of public hearings. Catholic Schools New South Wales distributes $3.5 billion in state and federal funding each year for the diocesan school system. It also raises more than $550 million in school fees and $100 million from other sources such as investments. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much. I'd like to make clear that dogs are not anti-religion. Religious beliefs are a matter of conscience and they're very personal. And that is why we think that they should have nothing to do with politics. It keeps them safe. The church-state entanglement is bad for religion as well as bad for our democracy. So let's have a break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR. Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. The people up in New South Wales, the New South Wales Teachers Federation, have always been perhaps the gutsiest of all the teachers' unions, and they have just had a conference, and a very interesting talk was given at this conference by a lady called Alison Pennington, an academic lady, and she pointed out that public provision of services is the solution to inflation. Now, public education, of course, is a public provision and it's being run down and the money's been going to the private schools for many years. Some people think it's just since Howard's time. It's not. It's since 1963. But Sorrell's going to tell us about the ideas and a paper given at the conference by Alison Pennington. Over to you, Sorrell.
Thanks, Jean. This article is entitled Alison Pennington, Public Provision is the Solution to Inflation, and was prepared by the New South Wales Teachers Federation Conference. Essential services that have shifted from public to private ownership over the past two decades are driving Australia's inflation crisis, Mackell Institute chief economist Alison Pennington told annual conference. Ms. Pennington has calculated the average annualised inflation rate for every item in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, basket over 20 years, from 2006 to 2026. While the average CPI ran at 2.8% a year, the fastest rising costs driving total inflation included gas 5.9% per year, electricity 5.7% per year, medical and hospital services 5.5% per year, water and sewage 4.6% per year, and housing 3.9% per year. They are all privatised services operating outside universal public systems, or were services once delivered by government for free or at very low cost. So much of the economy now has been handed over to private interests, including services like education, she says. Ms. Pennington proposes the longest lasting structural fix to inflation is public provision, because it is deflationary. Under times of big inflation, Australian companies are going to be facing pressures to profit maximise and raise prices. And that's why public ownership and delivery by our own governments, subject to the democratic will of its people, is the only solution that delivers non-profiteering, controlling inflation and lifting the living standards of its people, she said. Ms. Pennington is advocating for government investment in public education and weaning private schools off the public teat, as growth in private education has been inflationary. Secondary education averaging 5.2% per year and preschool primary education 3.9% per year over 20 years. Nationalising the childcare sector, expanding Medicare, public-owned renewables, and public-led housing programs. Ms. Pennington reminded delegates that in the 1980s, workers accepted wage restraint to deal with inflation in exchange for Medicare, better public education, better employment and pensions, and universal superannuation under the Prices and Incomes Accord. But she said much of this social wage, collective good, and services provided by the government has been severely eroded. The social wage that we fought for has been chopped off and sold off. Ms. Pennington proposed other solutions to build an economy that works for everyday people, including lifting compulsory superannuation as an alternative to interest rates, legally capping what companies can charge, tax sudden unearned profit spikes, introduce a land wealth levy for fortunes over $20 million. Alison Pennington is the author of the book Gen F, How Young Australians Reclaim Their Uncertain Futures, and is an adjunct senior research fellow in PPE with La Trobe University. Alison has held previous roles in unions, think tanks, federal public administration, and is a former senior advisor to cabinet ministers in the Albanese federal government. Back over to you, Jean.
Thank you very much, Sorrel. Now we have Andy. Trevor Kobold has written about private schools who want a $1 billion slush fund to stay forever. Let's hear about it.
Thanks, Jean. Private schools want $1 billion slush fund to stay. Private schools have opened a campaign to have the $1.2 billion choice and affordability slush fund extended beyond 2029 when it is due to end. In Senate estimates last month, Liberal Senator Maria Kovacic repeatedly questioned Department of Education officials whether the fund will be continued after 2029. Senator Walsh, representing the Minister for Education, said no decision has been made about the future of the fund. In the lead-up to the next election, the government can expect more pressure to continue this privileged funding, which is additional to the current needs-based system. To his credit, Senator Walsh pointed out that Catholic and independent schools are funded at 100% or more of their schooling resource standard, the SRS, while public school funding is less than 100%. He said that the government's focus was on ensuring that public schools will be funded at 100% of their SRS. Clearly, Senator Kovacic was not concerned about the long period of huge underfunding of public schools. She did not raise a single question about the continuing underfunding of public schools. Her sole concern was that Catholic and independent schools do not lose their slush fund. Officially called the Choice and Affordability Fund, CAF, it was notoriously labelled a slush fund by former New South Wales Coalition Education Minister Adrian Piccoli when it was introduced by the Morrison government in 2018 as part of a new $4.6 billion funding deal for private schools. Piccoli said the package was throwing money at the powerful and well-connected. The CAF funding of $1.2 billion over 10 years from 2020 to 2029 is split between Catholic schools receiving $740 million and independent schools $464 million. Public schools are not eligible for this funding. Over the 5 years 2020 to 2024, a total of $553 million has been distributed, $340 million to Catholic school organisations and $213 million to independent school organisations. The fund is just another special deal for private schools that adds to their resource advantage over public schools. It is funding provided to private schools outside their funding model and is not based on need. There are five priorities of the CAF: funding for initiatives that facilitate parental choice, transition funding support for non-systemic independent schools to adjust to the new funding model introduced by the Morrison government, funding for schools facing special financial circumstances, improving outcomes for schools and educationally disadvantaged schools and students, and improving student wellbeing and support. In 2024, the latest available figures, CAF expenditure was $137.5 million, which was provided to 1,348 private schools. The large part of this was spent in supporting choice and transitional assistance, $59 million to 634 schools for choice and $56 million to 448 schools for transitional assistance. The funding for choice is used for a range of purposes, including helping schools to understand how parents choose a school for their children and strategies to increase and retain enrolments. Direct grants for fee remission for disadvantaged schools or students and or support for schools that provided fee concessions to families. Supporting financial governance and professional learning on financial management and financial literacy, strategic planning for school capital assets. The transitional funding assistance is to support non-systemic independent schools experiencing a reduction in per student funding as a result of the introduction of the Direct Measure of Income, DMI, method of funding introduced in 2020. It is also available to schools transmitting to a new capacity to contribute, CTC score, that determines their recurrent Commonwealth Government funding. It includes funding for financial governance and management, assisting schools with access to expert knowledge in analysing existing business models and financials to support transition planning, and additional staff support. Under an extraordinary arrangement, the fund money is distributed to schools by representatives of Catholic and independent school organisations, not the National Department of Education. The Catholic and Independent Non-Government Reform Supports Funds, NGRSF, allocate the funds to their affiliated schools. Each fund is composed of representatives of state and territory Catholic and Independent Schools Associations. They are required to submit work plans to the Commonwealth Government and annual reports on the funding. The CAF was always a slush fund. It was introduced by the Morrison government as compensation for the abolition of the system-weighted average socioeconomic status, SES, score applied to Catholic systemic schools that was negotiated as a special deal with the Gillard Labor government. Under this deal, Catholic school systems were funded according to a negotiated statewide average SES score instead of the SES score of individual schools as applied to independent schools. As a result, they got more funding than they would have if the needs-based formula had been strictly implemented. The Turnbull government's Gonski 2.0 funding arrangements abolished this special deal and assessed parental capacity to contribute in Catholic systemic schools according to their individual SES score. It means that Catholic schools would receive less funding in the future than if the special deal continued to apply. This was at the heart of this Catholic school campaign against the Turnbull government's Gonski 2.0 funding model. The Morrison government simply bought them off with a slush fund of just over $0.7 billion over the next decade. The independent sector's share of the slush fund was designed to compensate them for a reduction in funding resulting from the shift to the DMI funding model. The Morrison government effectively guaranteed that the funding of independent schools would not be reduced. Adrian Pickley was prescient in labelling the CAF a slush fund. It is yet another special deal for private schools as icing on the private school overfunding cake. The private school funding model is effectively a choice mechanism by providing highly subsidised access to private schools, which is a major factor in the continuing enrolment shift. The CAF undermines the Gonski funding model by selectively making additional funding available for private schools in rural and remote areas, but not for public schools. It should be abolished. Clearly, continuation of the CAF beyond 2029 is on the campaign agenda of private school organisations for the 2028 federal election. Public school organisations need to push against continuing the fund. This sweetheart deal for private schools should end by 2029 as planned. No more special deals for private schools. No more indeed. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much for that. Very interesting. But now Dale is going to tell us something that was in The Educator this week. Big mining companies are pushing into our Australian schools. They're trying to propagandise our children.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Educator. Big mining companies push into Australian schools. Report. The branded science kit in the classroom. The logo on the local footy jersey, the sponsored excursion to the science centre. On their own, these things seem harmless enough, generous even. But a new investigation suggests they may be part of something far more calculated. A report by Comms Declare has found Australia's largest coal, oil and gas companies, including Santos, Shell, Chevron and BHP, have spent tens of millions of dollars on more than 260 teaching programs, sports sponsorships and partnerships in childhood settings, with the funding often used to drive industry recruitment women or influence educational materials. The report raises serious questions about the extent of fossil fuel industry engagement with children and young people, and whether parents are being given sufficient transparency about who is influencing their children and why. Parents for Climate CEO Nick Seaton said the findings warrant an immediate Senate inquiry. "This investigation reveals something every Australian parent has a right to know," Seaton said in a statement. "Australia's biggest fossil fuel companies are building relationships with our children through the very institutions families trust most, from schools and museums to science centres, sporting organisations and community programs." Seaton said parents shouldn't have to wonder whether the organisations they trust are helping fossil fuel companies win the trust of the next generation. "As a parent, I find that deeply disturbing. These companies are making billions selling polluting products, driving climate change, while building positive relationships with the very generation that will live with the consequences the longest," Seaton said. "Parents spend years carefully choosing who influences their children. We don't expect fossil fuel companies to be on that list." Seaton said the situation is akin to schools inviting tobacco companies into classrooms to teach children about health. "Why are fossil fuel companies being welcomed into places families trust?" Seaton said. "Parents have a right to know who's talking to their children, what they are saying, and whose interests they are serving. Right now, we simply don't." Back to you, Jean.
Well, many thanks, Dale. And now Jeff is going to take us overseas.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to start in Florida, where the Republican government has done its best to channel money away from public education and into private education via a system of universal vouchers, which is supposed to give children or parents choice as to where they send their children. Unfortunately, what it means is it bleeds the public education system, and supposedly for better results. But let's see what happened. This article comes from The Conversation, and it's from the 6th of July, 26, and it's by Kendall Deas, D-E-A-S. He's Assistant Professor of Education and Policy, Law and Politics at the University of South Carolina, and he's written an article called "Florida's School Choice Program Offers Universal Vouchers But Cannot Show System-Wide Academic Improvement." And it begins, "The Florida Department of Education cannot account for the U.S. $270 million that is spent through its school choice program. That's according to the November 2025 state audit of the department. The same audit shows the department also doesn't know which schools, if any, more than 30,000 kindergarten to 12 students in the state attend. During the 2026 legislative session, which ended March 13, 26, State Senator Don Gates, a Republican and advocate for school choice, introduced legislation that would have tightened the reins on how Florida's Family Empowerment Scholarship Program distributes funds. The program allows any family in Florida, regardless of income, to use state funding to pay for private or parochial school children for its kindergarten to 12 children, or even to homeschool them. The Florida House voted down Gates' proposed reforms, and so the problems found in the audit remain unaddressed for now. Florida hasn't always taken such a laissez-faire approach to its school choice program. The state has been in the school choice game since 1999, and its program has evolved significantly since then. Today, Florida operates one of the most expansive school choice systems in the U.S. I'm a researcher in education, public policy and law, and I've been investigating the evolution and education results of Florida's school choice program. I'm seeking to answer a critical question. After 27 years of school choice, has Florida shown that using public funds for private education helps students achieve better results academically? The history of school choice is a headline. Florida's use of public money to expand the school choice and vouchers to attend private and parochial schools began in 1999 as two targeted programs for special needs and low-income students. In 2006, the private school voucher allowance for low-income students was nullified by the Florida Supreme Court in Bush v. Holmes. The court held that the program violated the provisions of the state's constitution, which requires that the state provide the public education for all, but allowed the public school transfer option to remain intact. School choice advocates learned from this ruling. Beginning in 2010, they began pushing legislation to extend and diversify the Florida Tax Credit Scholarships Program. programs involving designs and funding mechanisms in Florida were created to avoid the constitutional concerns of Bush v. Holmes while expanding school choice throughout the state. School vouchers for all. The biggest change to school choice in Florida by far came in March 2023 when Florida House Bill 1 was signed into law. This law converted existing scholarship programs into universal education savings accounts while at the same time removing income eligibility limits. The law effectively gives a $9,000 per year voucher, the equivalent of what the state spends on each public school student, to any Florida K-12 student, regardless of disability status or family income. Most significantly, it allows funds tied to students to be redirected away from public schools into the accounts families can use for private tuition, curriculum, tutoring, and other approved expenses. These include everything from school supplies and dance lessons to televisions and trips to Disney World. Funding and enrollment in Florida's school choice program have grown dramatically since Florida's House Bill 1 was signed in March 2023 and went into effect in July 2023. As of February 26, more than 500,000 students are reportedly participating in these programs, which also means that many students have opted out of public school. Show me the money. Critics of the policy have always argued that redirecting per student funds into education savings accounts reduces resources for districts' public schools because funding follows students out of the public school system. Supporters of the policy counter that school choice will improve student achievement and parental control. State estimates and independent analyses project multi-billion dollar annual shortfalls in public education funding in the state since universal expansion. Analysts believe more Florida families will opt for education savings accounts in the future. Meanwhile, Gates's questions about accountability for funding and students are still looming. A question of results. But has the use of school choice and vouchers led to greater student achievement in Florida? At best, the evidence is mixed and inconclusive. While Florida's expansion of vouchers and other comparable programs coincided with large increases in private school enrollment and growth in choice options, there is limited research connecting these programs to system-wide gains in student achievement. For example, one 2020 report highlights research showing modest gains for public school students in standardized test scores and pass rates, but the effects vary by contexts. Within individual subgroups, results are mixed and don't show uniform system-wide gains. The research shows that after voucher expansion, public school students' standardized test scores improved slightly. During that time, there are also non-academic improvements, such as lower absenteeism and suspension rates in some schools. However, the gains were larger in areas with more pre-existing private school options and for lower-income students, with other districts seeing little or no benefit. Local analyses of districts throughout the state, such as Miami-Dade document, who uses vouchers, patterns of movements between public and private schools, and demographic differences. But these analyses by themselves don't show that vouchers enhance student achievement in Florida. Students who use vouchers differ from those who remain in public schools based on indicators such as family income. Vouchers benefit more students from middle-class families, students with a prior record of achievement and motivation to achieve academic success. This is because even with a voucher, students from low-income families often still struggle financially to attend private and parochial schools and experience logistical challenges such as transportation to attend these schools. Moreover, students from middle-class backgrounds use vouchers. These differences make simple score comparisons between students receiving vouchers and those who remain in the public school system misleading. In short, richer and higher achieving students tend to opt out of public school. Limited data nationwide. The case of Florida reveals some of the structural limitations with K-12 education data in measuring student academic achievement. Many children in Florida attending private, parochial or home school programs do not take the Florida Assessment of Student Thinking or FAST test, which is used by Florida's public school districts to measure students' achievement. This means that there's no apples-to-apples comparison of how they're doing academically. And Florida is not alone in this. No US state currently has a single assessment test taken by all students in all schools that might allow clear statewide comparisons. Where less descriptive studies exist nationally, the effects of voucher programs through school choice vary by program design, student subgroups, and local content. This is the main reason national results regarding the effectiveness of voucher programs in improving student achievement can't be generalized to the case of Florida. A 2024 report by the RAND Corporation reveals the challenge of generalising national results regarding the effectiveness of voucher programs and education savings accounts to individuals states like Florida. After 27 years of school choice, Floridans should know that there are no uniformly public positive system-wide gains in achievement. So that's the end of the article. So apparently, for all the money it's cost and the bleeding of billions of dollars from the public education system, there's absolutely no evidence that voucher program has raised standards. In fact, quite the reverse. It seems like maybe there's a slight increase in the quality of public education. Okay, we're going to go to an English article now from Varsity Magazine, dated from the 14th of July 26 from Cambridge, UK. This is by Holly Farrell, and it's The Myth of the Grammar School. Holly Farrell examines the position of grammar schools within England's education system and argues that they're not the answer to education inequality. There can't be many other places on earth where the question of state and private education is as politically polarising as in the UK. It's almost become general knowledge that only 7% of the British population are privately educated, yet this 7% is vastly overrepresented in the most influential jobs in Oxbridge admissions. Holders of the top jobs in politics, the judiciary, media and business are five times more likely to have been privately educated, while in 2022 the proportion of places offered to private school students at Oxford and Cambridge was 32 and 27% respectively. However, within this apparently neat division between state and private, there is a third school type, the grammar school. Although not fee-paying, grammar schools' academic selectivity firmly distinguishes them from comprehensive schools, where all abilities are taught together. Grammar schools were first introduced by the 1944 Education Act as a state school pathway for pupils focused on academic rather than vocational studies. It certainly started with good intentions, but within two decades, it became clear that this system reinforced the class divisions that they were largely introduced to address. In 1965, the government ordered local authorities to start phasing out grammar schools, and in 1998, Labor's School Standards and Framework Act outlawed the establishment of any new grammar schools. However, both laws failed to fully eradicate pre-existing grammar schools. 163 remain in England and a further 69 in Ireland. Grammar schools remain a contentious issue. Although they are certainly institutions of high academic attainment, it's hard to deny that they have failed to encourage social mobility. First of all, rather than offering a pathway for all children regardless of background, grammar schools are largely dominated by the middle classes. This can be seen by statistics relating to the proportion of pupils in pupil premium, a classification denoting that a pupil has received free school meals at any point in their school life. Although the national average stands at 27% of pupils being classed as pupil premium, this is only 8.1% at grammar schools. Students' more advantaged background can largely be traced to the entrance exam, known as the 11 Plus. Preparation for the 11 Plus has become a vast industry, with parents spending thousands on revision books, tuition services or higher quality primary school education to maximise their children's chance of success. Such a system further disadvantages those unable to afford the extra support. Secondly, there's evidence that grammar schools are not just unlikely to improve academic attainment, but are also likely to worsen attainment at local comprehensive schools. Research from the Evidence Centre for Education at Durham University has found there's no clear evidence of positive effect of grammar schools on exam grades. Meanwhile, pupils attending comprehensive schools in areas with grammar schools perform slightly worse at GCSE than their counterparts in regions without selective education. It's fair to say, then, that grammar schools have not just failed to promote social mobility, but in some cases actively discouraged it. My own time, the author says, at a grammar school has made me acutely aware of its shortcomings. Although I'm grateful for the opportunities I had, which I most likely wouldn't have had at my local comprehensive school, I'm also the first person to say that the system is flawed. As such, I've often found myself puzzled by the credit grammar schools receive as agents of social mobility. That is, until I realised that some of the biggest grammar school fans I've met were privately educated. Grammar schools provide an almost perfect myth of meritocracy. A state school with a very high academic attainment, open to those who can pass an exam no matter their background. As long as grammar schools exist, pupils unable to afford a private education will still have access to a high quality education with all of the promises of future success. As long as grammar schools exist, the myth of meritocracy lives on and the advantage of private education can be conveniently ignored. Such a flawed perspective neglects the very factor at the root of educational inequality. It's not the institution per se that generates disadvantage, but the financial resources behind it. As seen in grammar school admissions, investment in tuition and educational resources will always be of advantage, whether a pupil is in the state or private sector. Through this, it's hardly surprising that the Sutton Trust has found that students admitted to Oxbridge from the state sector mostly come from better-off backgrounds. Grammar schools are certainly not a magic bullet to fixing educational inequalities, although it may be convenient to think that such innovations could fix our unequal system, we're missing the true crux of the matter. Education requires investment, and more of or fewer grammar schools will not change that. If we're truly serious about reducing inequality between state and private sector, the only answer is to invest. So that is the end of the article. I think that's a really interesting and yet another pebble in the bucket, which shows that your educational outcome is vastly more affected by your family's income and the ability to access resources at your school. So more money into public schools, the better the outcomes will be. Wow, who would have thought? With that, I'm going to head you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you well. Cheerio.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And we've certainly been throwing a great deal of facts, figures and interesting information at you. So let's have a break.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because this is the best part of the program, our great state school. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Nidri Autistic School. Nidri Autistic School is a short-term intensive transition school for children with autism from prep to currently grade 3. We are dedicated to supporting each student as they move toward greater independence and success. Our approach is centred on a deep understanding of each student's unique strengths, needs, and the necessary adjustments to help them thrive. We focus on creating comprehensive student profiles that guide their progress and ensure a smooth transition to other educational settings. Our pedagogy is informed by individualised learning plans developed collaboratively with parents and allied health professionals, including speech and occupational therapists. At the heart of our approach is a strong emphasis on developing social communication skills, which are integrated into every aspect of our students' daily experiences. At NAS, our teaching and learning programs place the individual student at the centre and incorporate students' strengths and interests into each learning experience. Leadership teams support teachers to embed high-level and evidence-based teaching practices that encompass individual student needs. A new campus will open in Term 4 this year on the site of the former East Keilor campus of Essendon Keilor College, which has been non-operational since late 2025. Current Year 3 students will begin transitioning to the site later this year. The campus is planned to expand to include Year 5 in 2028, so students can continue their education in a specialist setting without disruption. It will have two classroom buildings with dedicated student amenities, a shared outdoor play area, and a central playground, all designed around their needs. The principal at Nidri Autistic School, Lauren Topp, says, "I couldn't be prouder of our students and what they achieve every day. This new campus gives them more space for specialist learning that will help them thrive." And now some info from the My School website. The school currently has 153 students and the ICSEA value 1,038. That's 21% in the top quartile of socio-educational advantage, 25% in the second quartile, 30% in the 25 to 50% quartile of socio-educational advantage, and 24% in the bottom quartile. 1% Indigenous students and 56% of the students have a language background other than English. And some financial figures. Now, these are from 2024, so it doesn't look like they include the funding for the new campus. But currently, in 2024 terms, the Australian Government recurrent funding is $1.964 million. State and Territory Government recurrent funding is $7.5 million. Fees, charges and parent contributions add another $5,000. And other private sources, $19,801. For a total gross income of $9.5 million. And that works out to $74,171 per student. The capital expenditure over the last 3 years, i.e. 2021 to 2024, Australian Government capital expenditure, $13,887, and from the Victorian Government, $55,000. Total capital expenditure, $69,000. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Nedry Autistic School, and our time is gone. So I'd like to remind you, of course, of the stop work on the 23rd of July, Thursday, next Thursday. We suggest you have a look at the AAU website for all of the details for that. And now I have to thank our producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and Sorrel, and Jeff. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR. Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.